Welcome everybody on behalf of JBD to this joint event between JBD and State Zionist, or Zionist Council of Victoria. I'm David Werdiger. For more information about JBD and the things we do, please check out our website jbd.org.au. I'm going to hand over straight to Ari Briggs, who's International Director of International Development for Regavim. You're going to find out all about Regavim. He's here. You're fundraising, aren't you, probably? Or raising awareness.
Awareness.
Is what we prefer to call it.
Awareness.
So I'm sure by the end of his presentation, you'll be very aware.
Over to you, Ari. So thank you very much, first of all, for setting this up after a couple of hiccups. how many of you guys have been to Israel? Hands up. Okay, how many of you have been to Papua New Guinea? So that's always the concern when I tell this joke in Australia. There will be some people who have been to Papua New Guinea. But anyway, there's an Israeli, a Brit and a Frenchman, and they've been captured by cannibals. And the cannibals have fired up the fire and got the cauldron boiling, and they're about to cut their heads off and throw them in. And the cannibals say to them, "Your final wish is now. This now is the time." The Frenchman says, "I'd like a glass of champagne." They bring him the glass of champagne. He drinks that. The Brit says, "A cup of tea, please." They bring over the cup of tea. He drinks a cup of tea. They come to the Israeli and say, "What's your final wish?" He says, "I'm going to bend over and I want you to give me the biggest kick in the tuchus that you can." Obviously not using that term because they don't know Yiddish, but the biggest kick in the tuchus, and that's my final wish. And the guy, even the cannibals thinking that's pretty strange, but the Israeli bends over and the cannibal gives him a kick in the tuchus, and he pulls out an Uzi from under his shirt. He shoots the cannibals, runs off with the Brit and the Frenchman. And after they've run and escaped the cannibals, the Brit and the Frenchman turn around to him and say, "Well, why? What are you doing? You know, you had that Uzi there all the time. Why did you wait?" The Israeli says, "I didn't want to be seen as the aggressor." So, and with that, what I want to go through is a very quick briefing. It's normally longer, but we don't have as much time. So I will race through it. What I'm going to do is go through issues that are facing the whole of the state of Israel today in regards to the land. 93% of the state of Israel is owned by the government, including the JNF lands, if we want to include that. Because that, and there is a distinction, but we don't need to get into that today. I can answer that later. But being at 93%, that's the obviously a very massive majority in the country, and there are issues with land management happening all around the country, which probably most people aren't aware of. So I'm going to go to Tel Aviv. This is a village called Damash, which has actually approached the UN and asked to be recognized as an independent Palestinian village. The only problem is that it's between Lod and Ramleh, about 3 kilometers from Ben Gurion Airport and about 8 kilometers from Tel Aviv. It is not beyond the green line. This is a village that was set up on agricultural land just over the years and has been neglected in terms of enforcing the law by the Israeli government. And now when they do want to enforce the law, they're requesting to be independent village, leave us alone, let us do what we want. In Jerusalem, massive amounts of illegal building of law breaking. This Begin Highway, which travels north-south, Jerusalem, there's some Bedouin tents here, but you can also see these three houses that came up overnight. Structures that can be put up overnight overlooking the highway, and we took this photo from the highway. Regavim investigates these issues and tries to get the authorities to deal with them. Up in the Galil, this is Meron Park, Har Meron. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Lag BaOmer, very closely related. This is research we did where you see the yellow dots here. They refer to illegal activity within the nature park and also on the outside within the agriculture area. So you can see houses being built, pools, clearings being made for industry and the rest. this is a video, an expose we did on Channel 10. Ooh, no sound.
בעל הבית מרוויח בית פסטורלי ואנחנו מפסידים עוד ועוד דונמים של טבע בשמורה הירוקה.
בשנה, שנה וחצי האחרונות רואים התגברות של הבנייה הלא חוקית בתחום שמורת הטבע. במהלך החודשיים האחרונים ניתן להתרשם מההתחלות הבנייה שמופיעות פה למטה.
הפקחים סופרים קרוב ל-30 התחלות בנייה, מרביתן כאן, בכפר חורפש. זה בנוסף למאות הבתים שנבנו בעבר בניגוד לחוק. אמנם הבתים נבנים על חלקות ששייכות לתושבים בטאבו, אבל בכל מה שקשור לישועי בנייה ופגיעה בטבע הייחודי, הם פשוט מצפצפים על רשויות החוק שמתקשות לעשות כאן סדר.
אני הייתי מביא את בית משפט.
ומה בית משפט אמר?
שום דבר, לא יודע, אני אביא את בית המשפט שלה.
וצו הריסה?
וצו הריסה.
פה לא יעשו.
לא.
לא עשו.
אנחנו טענו כ-30 פלישות, כתוב שמועת הטבע בהר מירון. פנינו לכל הגורמים האמונים על העניין. קיבלנו תשובות שהנושא בבדיקה, בטיפול, כן בתחום אחריות שלנו, לא בתחום אחריות שלנו. ואנחנו מתכוונים לפנות לכל מי שפטר בזמן הקרוב.
צריך להיות תמיד פה בזהירות לשניהם, לא
לעורר מומה. לפני שבועיים הותקף פקח שבא לתת כאן צו להפסקת עבודה. לכאן לא נכנסים לבד.
הם לא נעימים, הם מאוד אגרסיביים שאני בא אליהם.
זה מעורר בך מחשבה שנייה כשאתה צריך עכשיו לגשת לכפר ולטפל בבנייה לחוקית כזאת?
כן, כל פעם שאני ניגש לכפר אני חושב איך אני יוצא מכאן.
הם יכלו להרוס רק דרך אדיר. תבואו, F-16,
תנטיל
וזו.
אז נכון, לתושבי הכפרים יש כיום מצוקת בנייה, אבל עדיין מותר לקוות שיקום הגורם שיעשה סדר לפני שכולנו נשאר בלי ירוק.
So the idea is that one day there will become an authority that will actually deal with this illegal behavior. Now, Regavis, as an organization, we do the research, we have researchers, we have the lawyers who then follow it up with letters to the authorities, trying to push the authorities to deal with a situation, and it surprised really the Norwegian ambassador fell off the chair, because I do briefings to our embassies there, that here is a situation where in Israel the unequal application of the law is dramatic, and unlike what everyone hears on the news, really it's the Jews there that are getting the bad deal, and our minorities, the Arabs, Druze, Bedouin, who are actually getting the good deal, and that's what we show. That's in the Galil, in the Golan Heights. This is the border with Syria. If you remember 2 years ago, Syrians came running off the hill, broke the border down and rushed into Majdal Shams. This photo was taken 4 years ago, so 2 years beforehand. We reported to the authorities, Defense Ministry, whoever would hear, wrote the letter saying, you've got a problem. We've got a problem. There's illegal houses being built right up to where their back garden is, the border fence with Syria. If anything ever happened, this is obviously a security concern, totally ignored. Until 2 years later, when the Syrians did come across and did make it into the houses and made it into Majdal Shams, and now they're starting to clear and make sure there's a sterile area, they've built a bigger fence, and they're clearing these houses out. But it's not just about security. This is the Hermon mountain range up here. This is the nature reserve of the Hermon. But the Majdal Shams local authority has handed out land titles, which they have no right to hand out, to Druze in their town to go and build their palaces while digging into the nature reserve. Yudin Shomron, interesting, in the West Bank, as many people call it. Here, most of the time, we hear about outposts, Jewish outposts, Jews going and setting up, but really about at least 20 to 1, if not 30 to 1, times as many Arab outposts setting up that no one ever hears about. It starts off with tents, with water, fuel, planting trees, to create more and more illegal building. We have recorded 30,000 illegal structures just in Yudin Shomron alone, 90,000 all over Israel. It starts like this, but it actually goes to this. This is a house south of Jerusalem, north of Gush Etzion. It's built illegally. It's outside the town plans. There are town plans. This is built in agriculture areas, so it's, you know, we think, oh, it's only a zoning issue. But that's a hell of a zoning issue. And the Israeli government does nothing about it. We reported to them when they were on the first floor. Of course, demolition order was given, but the Arabs know Israel, as the guy said in the Galil, Israel will never demolish a house like this or any other house, and we'll find out about why.
Is that a single-family home?
That's a single-family home. I mean, you know, they have big families, so we'll talk about that in the Negev. But I think it's even a holiday home, so I don't know. Okay, if you've ever travelled from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea, this is Road 1, Ma'ale Adumim up here on the hill, you would have seen Bedouins living all over. Regavim actually has tracked and marked out and done the research to list every single place that these the Bedouin living, taking over. This is all state-owned land out of that 93%. without having been leased to anyone. They go and settle there. It used to be quite difficult, but the Palestinian Authority, if you look very closely, supplies them with free water. Very different from what we hear. Some of you might have heard about the water apartheid. I mean, this is free water that's given their tanks. They've given them tanks, then the tankers go and fill up whenever they want water, which allows them to sit pretty much anywhere, even though it's a desert-type environment on the way down to the Dead Sea. It endangers, of course, this is a main highway. You've got kids, you've got cars, people, flocks crossing a main highway. You've got a school above here that happens to have a lot of rocks on the road below it. No idea why. Here, you know, we did the report. The government's trying to deal with it, but again, you let things get out of hand for long enough, it becomes a bigger and bigger problem. Ecological damage. These are ancient terraces. This happens to be in the West Bank and Yunnan Shamron. A criminal family has put up a barrier. Boomgate has a guy on the gate charging 150 shekels for a truck to come and dump its waste over here, which is how this has been built, and making a lot of money. But this is illegal behavior, but it goes on continuously. We have issues with water, as you know, all over the Middle East. This is an illegal well, an illegal drill that reaching down again hundreds of meters into the water sources, which, and if you understand, with water sources you take from one place, it's not going to be in another place. It is very highly controlled in Israel, and here it is, European Union funded drilling without any approval of the Israeli authorities. And I'm talking about Area C here, not Area A or Area B. But what about the Negev? Negev make up two-thirds of the country before 1967. Our dear First Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion spoke about the Negev being the test of the nation of Israel. And we have a situation where we were brought up with a myth about the Bedouins that was not a myth in the 40s, 50s, 60s. They did live at certain stages in tents, but whenever I went to Israel in the 70s, 80s, I'm sure, many of you went on a tour bus, stopped off at the Bedouin tent, got out, had some coffee, they made the pitas, and you went on the camel ride and thought, wow, these Bedouin are fantastic. And more so than that, not only are they great cooks and coffee and the camels, but they also served in the army, they were best trackers and so on. We were all brought up on this. Both of them are myths. Back in the 70s, about 30% of eligible males were in the army. They were good trackers. They are good trackers. Today, less than 0.5% of them, of eligible males, actually go in the army. They also do not live in tents. They haven't lived in tents since the 60s. Today, they live in towns and villages that look like this. There are bigger towns. There are smaller towns. And we'll see some of those. Those are just two examples. And the Israeli government understood that the Bedouin was a challenge. These are citizens of Israel, and the country needs to supply them with services. But they were challenged because there are 200,000 Bedouins in the Negev. 130,000 of them live in Israeli towns that were set up in the 70s. Every 10 years in Israel, they put on a royal commission. Not a royal commission, it's just a supreme. They get an ex-Supreme Court judge to run a commission to look into how to solve the problem. Why? Because there are those seven towns they set up after one commission in the 70s. But there's another 70,000 Bedouin who have pretty much squatted wherever they want in the northern Negev. They have claimed from the 70s about 200,000 acres of land in the area between Beersheba, Arad, and Dimona. And this was a map that was developed by Oxfam, not our best friend, and given to every NGO supporting the Bedouins as well as the Bedouin, the heads of the Bedouin clans and tribes, saying, look, the Jews have 400,000, we're 200,000, the Jews have 100 towns, we should therefore be allowed to have 50 towns. We have seven legal towns, we have 45 other illegal towns. Legalize them, you've solved the problem. Problem solved. And the commission, they believe that. They don't leave that ivory tower in Jerusalem. They don't take the aerial flights that we put on. They don't go and see that it's actually impossible to count these 45 towns, because there aren't 45 towns, there are many more. So what we came into that commission, we showed them, based on our mapping software, that there's not 45 towns, but hundreds, if not over 1,000 of these towns. Anyone today with Google Earth can see that very clearly. But not what a commission sees. So this was the map of unrecognized Arab Bedouin villages that is has become fact. It starts off with Adala, legal center for Arab minority They say myths and misconceptions. Number 5, Arab Bedouin live in scattered unknown settlements. This is a myth. Connecting the settlements infrastructure is impossible, unprecedented. There are 45 permanent, no villages, of which 10 is in the process of being legalized. So we have 35 left that are illegal. That's all we're talking about here. I'm rushing this through because we have limited time, but everything's available on the website. Now it's down to 39. Some have been approved, some haven't. This is Human Rights Watch, all our best friends. Negev Coexistence Forum, it's one of the NIF's, Australia's sponsored organizations, because they do an amazing job, and this is on their website. They use Google Earth. They say, here, we've mapped out the unrecognized, what we call illegal villages for you. You can take a look at them. What they don't understand is today people can just click on the satellite or terrain and take a look in, and what we see is those same blue dots, but we keep zooming in, and we find that, wait, there's one dot here, but you've got many villages all around it. This is on their website. You can see here, maps.google.com. Here's, again, another 4 or 5 blue, but then what about all these other clusters of buildings, villages between them? Adala says, recognize the unrecognized villages, and you've solved the plan. Withdraw the government plan, but follow our plan, and you'll solve it. NIF, recognize unrecognized Bedouin villages. It's all the same mantra. That is what the embassies understand in Israel. So what we do is we came to the commission. Here's the map of Israel: Dead Sea, Mediterranean, Gaza, Beersheba in the middle, northern Negev. And what we did, we plotted where they say there are the 45 towns and villages. We also plotted the other Bedouin towns: Rahat, Lakia, Hura, Segev Shalom, etc. The Jewish towns, Beersheba, mixed town, Nevatim Air Force Base, southern West Bank, or the Yehuda, Gaza Strip. These are army bases or air force bases. Blue is the Jewish towns. The yellow is the so-called 45. And so what we did, we just zoomed in and we showed them. If you zoom in and actually get to a place where you need to go for the aerial photography, we get to a situation, we see that one yellow dot sometimes falls on some houses, sometimes doesn't. But the more accurate way to map it out is to go and mark it with a red mark around clusters, 5 clusters and above, and then start zooming out. And you see that one yellow dot represents 10, one yellow dot represents 30. Then we see, again, 4 yellow dots, but there are probably more than 100 of these clusters. And then if we've zoomed right out, that's Beersheba, 200,000 people. The red areas represent, not the red area of Yehuda, but the red areas here represent 70,000 Bedouins spread out over 200,000 dunam. And you can see sometimes the yellow dots does match an area, but then there are big areas without any yellow dots. So the idea of solving the problem by just legalizing 45 unrecognized villages only leads you on a path that will ensure that you will recognize hundreds of these unrecognized or illegal villages, and again, built on state lands. So, taking the view even bigger, what we're seeing here is, again, that's marked in red. Here, the whole of the northern Negev, you can see around the roads, you can see around the Nevatim Air Force Base, you can see bordered on Beersheba. That's that triangle, 70,000 of them live. What we do is we take an example, Al-Sira. They realize that once we've shown these maps, the commission isn't going to believe them, so they go to the UN. And what does the UN say? The UN says they send a special repertoire. And as we know, Bedouin came from 1700s, 1800s from the Hejaz region, which is today Saudi Arabia. They spread out over the whole Middle East. They're nomadic. They were looking for greener pastures. Some of them went to the Negev, but they also went to the Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, Iraq, Sinai, Egypt. But the UN, being the intelligent guys they are, came and did a study on the Bedouin of the Negev, especially Al-Sira, which they were brought to because they had demolition orders on them. 350 indigenous Bedouins, 50 houses stretching out over 4 square kilometers, stating very clearly that they have lived through for generations in the area, in that location, throughout the Ottoman administration, the British mandate. Therefore, they were there before the Jews arrived, of course, in 1948, when the state of the Jews was established. Therefore, they are indigenous. They're the only Bedouin, the only place that the Bedouin are indigenous in the whole Middle East happens to be in the Negev of Israel. So again, we say, okay, this went to court, Al-Sira, what's the story there? We bring up not only information, imagery of today, but we go back and look at historical data. 2003, there's Al-Sira. It existed. 1990, again, we're going back and trying to show the UN it's not Ottoman, it's not British mandate. So 1990, we still see something. 1978, 1967, there are a few tents there. 1945, thanks to the British, they were very efficient bureaucracy. They did do aerial photography in that time. The geography professors, Professor Ruth Kark, Hebrew University, says there's no one living in this area, and that is that area. If you look back, you see the that there matches up with this there. And they're saying they weren't living there. And it makes sense. Bedouin means actually Bedou is desert, but they are nomadic people. They weren't there that year. They might not have been there for 10 years. They might never have been there. It depends where the grass was green. They were moving their flocks around. They didn't have ownership papers. They never bought any. They never paid taxes on it. The idea was they were nomadic. They settled down, as we'll see, in the 60s, 70s, 80s. You can see the big change happened in the 90s, 93. Take a look at this field. We'll just see what happens to space, areas, open areas, state-owned land in the Negev. Not much settlement back in 93. Same area. You're seeing there's more. 1999, 2003, and where it becomes white, it means it's solid structures already. Remember that field is still there. Okay, now, actually, taking a larger zoom out, we're seeing that that's happening crisscrossing this whole area, and we can see a larger and larger area that back in 1993, there was very sparse numbers of people living in the area. Today, many. Now, what does that look like? What do those look like? These are the houses. If you go off the road, this is what you'll find in those illegal villages. Not all of them will look like this. There are also smaller, there are metal shacks, there are huts, but within the metal you'll normally find that they're placing the blocks, because as soon as they put down blocks, they're meant to get a demolition order. They get away with it for enough time, they take down the metal sheeting, and suddenly there's a nice house they've built behind it. That's how they all start. That's our research. That's what we've got to try and understand what's happening behind the metal and get the authorities to come in. But these are all houses in illegal, unrecognized Bedouin villages. Okay, so now, I haven't specifically gone for the big ones. I can find big houses also in Rahat and Lakia and Hura. These are the illegal ones. Why do they need such big houses? One of the issues of the Bedouins, or challenges of the Bedouins, is they have the highest growth rate in the world in terms of their population, 5.6%. It means they double every 15 years. So whereas there were 10,000 in 1945, there are now 200,000 today, and 2025 there will be 420,000. How does that happen? One Bedouin man needs 3 to 4 wives. That's his Bedouin tradition. Even though polygamy is illegal in Israel, for some reason Israel lets them get away with it. And where they have an issue, actually there was a new Bedouin member of Knesset who got elected recently. He had a big issue. He's invited with his wife to come to the opening of the new Knesset, but he has 3 wives. So what does he do? So he doesn't bring any of them. Just so he doesn't bring the issue up into the open. It's not in the open. People don't realize that's what's going on. This is just to give you an idea of how they build. They build behind the metal, and then suddenly the roof's already on. They've got away with it. Then it's a court case that goes on for years and years and years, and at the end of the day, Israel doesn't demolish it anyway. and as you can see, for the 4 wives, used to be a tent for each wife. Now it has to be a different floor for each wife, different satellite channel for each wife. I don't know. Okay, so how do they afford to live there, to take the land, the 20 kids, the 3, 4 wives? I'm not saying more wives are more expensive, but that's what some people say. So they do it through illegal businesses, dump sites, pirate petrol stations, which is a weird concept, building material supply companies. Everything is off the books. They don't pay for the land. They don't pay any tax on the land to the town council, because there is no town council. They don't register businesses. They set up what they want, where they want. commercial businesses.
Sewage and power.
Okay, so we'll see some of the pictures. You have now solar panels supplied by the European Union and other NGOs. They're supplying them power so they don't have to ever connect up to the grid. Their sewage, they just do what they need to do and dig holes. They're not poor people. There are some poor Bedouins. They're not the ones who are claiming the land that make up about 16% of those. A lot of them are involved in smuggling. And again, these are clans that have the same clans over in Sinai. The Sinai-Negev border is milestones, and the term milestone come from a stone every mile. So very easy to bring in, not just human trafficking. Israel was put on the red list with the U.S. State Department because of women coming through the Negev from Sinai, but also drugs, very profitable, and weapons, which is obviously very concerning. It was a very good way. They couldn't get through the Gaza border fence. They would take it back into Sinai, then bring it over from Sinai to the Negev and up into the West Bank. So this is what Omer, if anyone's heard of a nice town called Omer, this is what the mayor of Omer says.
We are a state within a state. We're not far from the day when Bedouins in the Negev will demand autonomy here.
Soon after that, he said that statement and publishes it. Then he's... aeroplane, which is right behind him, got burnt down at a airfield, which should really be something like national infrastructure, but it's guarded by two 12-year-old Bedouin boys because they're paid off. It's a whole protection racket going and extortion going on there as well, but he didn't want to play along with that. So what does Israel look like today? We took the same map and we just marked all the illegal building also up in the north, and in the south we coloured the whole of West Bank red because that's what the rest of the world already believes it's taken away from Israel. And we see it's nearly contiguous from Lebanon down through West Bank, down to the Sinai, to the Gaza Strip. And compare that to the 1947 UN partition plan. You're starting to see there's a model being put in place here. So what about the ramifications? As I mentioned, it's not just about illegal building. It's all illegal behavior. When law enforcement pulls out of an area, there's no such thing as a vacuum in the law. Other criminal elements move in. We know it from Chicago, we know it from New York, and we know it from the south and the north of Israel, where you have massive amount of crime, theft, protection, extortion, hooliganism, and it goes all over Israel. There is a lot longer video, which you'll see on our website, done by, again, news exposés, which shows different clans take on different towns. Ra'anana has one clan, Herzliya has another one, Tel Aviv has another one. They leave at night and go and take what they want in the other cities. That would take too long. That's about the protection. I can show that to you afterwards. Now, the Bedouin themselves used to be the chilonim, the secular of the Islamists, because they were traveling around. They didn't sit down and learn the Quran, have the mosque. But since they have settled down, there is massive influence coming from the northern Islamic branch, making them more and more radical. The influence in the mosque, they have the education system where the teachers are coming from the north because they have the Arabic and the Hebrew. The Ministry of Education employs these people to come and teach them radical Islam. And the yearly building days where guys get on a bus, hundreds of these guys get on buses 2 days a year, Friday and Saturday, spend down the south building illegal houses to take over more and more territory. Adala, which you mentioned before, just a couple of things. You know, they say that Israel is actually trying to truncate this Palestinian identity and it's distorted Israeli Arab identity. So whereas when they were speaking about Bedouins in the 2000, 2005, 2006, the UN spoke about Israeli Arab Bedouins. Then it went to Arab Bedouins living in the Negev. Now it is Palestinian Bedouins. So the whole terminology has changed as well. And again, the idea that the conflict is not only Gaza Strip and West Bank, but it's actually also the Arab-Israelis. It's all part of the same conflict. This is what their mosques, when they did settle down, used to look like. There's the study hall and the minaret. The new ones look like this. Of course, the dome being in, remembering the Alaska Mosque in Jerusalem. Every new house built there today has a picture of the Dome of the Rock above the mantle, above the door. Raed Salah got in trouble in London, but they let him out. He's the head of the northern branch. This was just the Bedouin growth rate that I mentioned before. I am running through this because I know you're going to have questions. So what should be done? The government has to re-establish law and order. They've pulled out. Police do not go into these places. When we take groups in their buses, even into the seven legal towns, they say we can't go in without a police convoy. And again, this is consensus Israel. This is the Negev. This is not the areas that we're usually under attack for. There's a lot that should be done, can be done. We don't blame the Bedouin here. We blame the government. Of course, they're responsible. It's the legal system. they've had many programs over the years where they've built towns and set up areas where they've given people, they give, again, the Bedouins to move off the illegal areas onto legal areas. They will give them a dunam, a quarter acre, half an acre, with infrastructure, with water, with sewage, with everything else, but they're left empty. Whether it's tribal, whether the tribe says, no, you can't go there, that's already mine. And this is a closer-up view where they've actually set up the land outside, new neighbourhoods outside the legal towns. The Bedouin aren't moving in because they can do a lot better outside the system. They don't have to pay taxes. They don't have to register. There's a lot of issues, and convincing them with a carrot hasn't seemed to work, but the government's not holding any big sticks. So the legal system... the attorney's office that has been infiltrated by the NIF over the last 20 years in a very excellent way of doing it don't actually fight anymore the land claims. They've been told if we do win a case, well then those Bedouins will never be able to even get to a compromise because the legal system's already ruled, so they don't turn up at the court cases anymore. I mean, it's a very interesting situation.
State attorney's
office, yeah. The law enforcement, as I mentioned, are told not to go into these towns, are told not to deal. They have to deal with the roads, and there is a video, half an hour video that came out just before expose, but just before the last election, that says what goes on in the Negev at night. You'll see it on the website. So why they're not doing it, and this is the big question, hesitant leadership and a fear of international backlash. And it sounds too simple to be true, but they're up against massive forces, of which some here you recognise. And Professor Amnon Sofer, let's see if that's internet's not working. Okay, you'll see that on the website. Here's a Professor Haifa, not a religious guy, actually a left-wing guy, but he's understood that there is a connection between the radical left in Israel and the Arabs in trying to take away as much land outside of the state of Tel Aviv as possible, funded by the likes of the NIF, European Union, George Soros, Ford Foundation, Switzerland, Christian Aid. This is the imagery that they want Israel. That's what they want on all the front pages of all the newspapers all around the world. This was taken off The Guardian. And this was the headline, this is the Independent, the Bedouin versus Israel's bulldozers, as Jewish settlers move into the desert to make it bloom. Okay, ancient way of life is under threat. This is 2011, Al-Sira, the one we spoke about with the UN. This is not Jewish settlers that we normally hear about, those terrible settlers. And this is not the West Bank, this is the Negev. So that's where it's moving to. What do we do? So as I mentioned, we're a research institute. This guy here, Marcus Maloff, his grandparents came from Persia, 1920s. They came to Ben-Gurion and said, we've got a bit of money. How should we spend it? We want to buy some land. Where should we be buying? They said, go and buy in the Negev. They bought their hundreds of dunams. They have the deeds. It just happens now that there are 350 Bedouin families living on that land. It's registered, it's his name in the land registry. We went to court on his behalf. This is not, a state land or national land issue. It's a private land, but it was important for us because it's one of those cases. It came out around the same time as Migron that Dorit Benesh made some amazing statements about the value of private land in our country and why we need to do everything to remove illegal squatters from their land. And here is the Negev, never been questioned, his land, all the documents. And we won the court case. The government was given 6 years to find them other homes. The most amazing thing is the government, one of the other cases we took was also the government had set up a school for the Bedouin on this guy's private land as well. So imagine, like, even the government's just ignoring its own laws. So we find the illegal houses, gather the evidence where it is, make sure that we can present it in court. First of all, go write the letters. When nothing happens, we do have to sue the government to try and get them to enforce their own laws. We also put together... as a think tank, we put together research papers and the rest because you do need to find a solution. You just can't go and throw people out of their homes. Well, you can. It just depends if you're Arab or Jewish. And again, talk about is Israel Supreme Court indeed the last refuge of the citizen? Some of the studies we've done. Okay, I'm really rushing this. How many minutes have I got? What we do outside Israel is this, also speaking to senators, diplomats, in the States, Washington, influencing diplomats, trying to let diplomats inside Israel understand what's going on, work with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, make sure we get our information into the embassy's hands outside of Israel. The British Embassy, I have a good contact there. They come to me, they say, look, we've got some information from all these famous NGOs that there's a Jewish town that's spewing sewerage into this Arab's field. What's the story? So this is the nitty-gritty that they're getting involved in Israel, a foreign embassy. They go to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It takes a month, 2 months to get back with some information. By then already the news is all on front cover of the newspapers around the world. They come to us because we've got researchers in the field. We go, we get them information, we tell them, look, the last 2 weeks has been very rainy in Israel. You have an overflow. There has been this and that issue. This is how the army is dealing with it. This is how the regional council is dealing with it, etc. And they need that information to counter what they're getting on a daily basis from these radical NGOs fighting against Israel. So we educate, we make people aware of the threats, counter NGOs promoting that information, and again, promoting the national interests of the state of Israel. Okay, remember this map. So what we call a silent surrender, if you think it's passive, or a silent conquest, if it's active. This is actually what's going on in Israel. As I showed, it's happening all over Israel. The time is actually running out. How can you participate in the struggle? Sponsor a research program. Go like us on Facebook. You'll get daily or weekly information about what we're doing. We do many Supreme Court battles. We are hated. Do a search for Rega Vim. I've got a brochure here. I've got my card. Do a search on the internet. You'll see that even though we're made up of 10 people, 3 researchers, lawyers, and operations people, every left NGO has something to say about us because we're successful. We've started to win. We're only a young organization from 2006, but we've started to win in the Supreme Court, in the Beersheba Court, all over the place. When we write letters today, the authorities actually react right back to us, do the research, check it out. But the judicial system in Israel has been abused, misused for the last 30, 40 years. That it is a real struggle and a real effort. And we do what we can. We try and build the most effective communication channels, not just inside Israel where we have all the exposés on television, but we're trying to get it out to people like yourselves. So when you are confronted by this type of allegations, water apartheid, Bedouins being pushed off their land, JNF Green Sunday, etc., you have the information on our website from us that can counter that as most effective as possible. And this is what we do. Thank you very much. Questions?
What defences do they run? What defences do they run when you go to the other side, the Bedouins? What defence?
They burn tyres. They
run up in the court.
In the courts.
Yeah.
They have they have the best lawyers, like Michal Spad and others. And their defence is that they've been there forever. They're an indigenous population. They don't have, again, the court is very happy to take any evidence of ownership of the land. And as I said, because they kept losing battle after battle, the state attorney's office doesn't even turn up anymore to defend Israel. So the court just says, okay, well, the state of Israel doesn't want to defend it anymore, so it doesn't give them ownership, it just does away with the case. So we've also in a case to try and force the state attorney's office to answer the allegations and the rest. It's a matter of getting geographers. Professor Yiftachel, Ben-Gurion University, is a big supporter of the Bedouin causes, so he comes and explains. Al-Arakib, if you do a search for that term, Al-Arakib, that's something that they beat JNF with all over the world. It was not included in those 45 towns because it is absolutely tiny, but now it's been added on. It's 46 now. As we mentioned, there are hundreds of them. That's somewhere where these people have so-called lived forever and this and that, but there's evidence, aerial photography evidence, that they weren't there for many, many years. They haven't been. We tracked where they actually live there, what Mercedes, class Mercedes they're driving, and they do have them. And we've got all the research, and it was used in court, where their houses are in Lod, in Ramla, in Kfar Qasim, in Rahat. So it's a land grab, pure and simple. Yeah.
When you contest these cases, do you usually do it on the basis of legal principle, or does it turn on fact?
Yeah.
So in other words, does Rega accept the concept of traditional ownership prior to the state and argue no, they weren't really there?
Yeah.
Or do you actually dispute the legal principle of judicial review?
So really, it's a government's role. It's a the government's meant to defend state lands. We're not there to defend state lands. What we're trying to do is drag the government into court to get it to defend our lands. And we will bring it evidence. We will show the evidence. We will join a case as an interested party and bring the evidence that the state has no... I mean, they just don't deal with. We'll bring the professors of geography from Hebrew University to try and allow the state to win these cases and force the state to actually go and contest the cases.
To turn my question around, what would the Bedouins have to demonstrate to convince Regevim that they do have a legitimate claim on it, in a particular instance?
They don't just win a case in court. We're not biased one way or the other. We just want the equal application of the law. So the same laws have to apply to Jews and Arabs in the country. So if a Jew has to show a purchase document, taxes paid back in 1858, Ottoman land laws, that's the basic of Israel's laws, also within the Green Line, also in the West Bank. And you do have to show that at some stage someone paid tax, or at some stage someone bought it. There are documents. The British were a very heavy bureaucracy, and they went and they actually surveyed the land and wrote down what was happening and who was there and what was there. There are ways to prove if you actually owned it. They just have not won one case that they've owned it. The government will still give them land. It will say, give up your claim, we'll give you 1 million shekels. If you have 100 dunam claim, we'll give you 1 million shekels, and we'll give you 20 dunams somewhere else. We'll give you all the infrastructure, the water, the sewage, and that. The government has bent over backwards, but they know something very well about Jews, that it starts off offering them 20% land, 80% money, and it goes to 30-70, 40-60, 50-50, 60-40. We're now at a stage of about 60-40. Benny Begin, the caretaker government, passed through the cabinet to hand over, on top of the 250,000 dunams that was agreed in the Prava Committee after the Goldberg Commission, an extra 100,000 dunams, an extra 25,000 acres, just to try and convince them to sign on the dotted line. And Benny Begin was assured by his Bedouin friends and the NGOs taking him around that they would accept that. Of course they said no, because it's racking up points, racking up. Once they've got the 350, now they're going for more. They've been told by the NGOs, don't accept anything but 100%. Israel has bigger problems than the Negev. They'll give it up in the end of the day.
Ari, extend this question. You can't have an adverse possessional claim against state land, I don't think, in Israel either.
Correct.
But private land, do they have adverse possession rights if a Jewish citizen did not exercise any rights of ownership of that land over 30, whatever the period of time is in Israel?
There are, again, part of those Ottoman laws says you can't go and take state lands. It doesn't matter how long you sit on it.
Yeah.
But private lands, there is a way to say, well, they weren't there and you developed the land and therefore you have a claim against it. But again, that comes to the courts and the judge has to decide. The judge asks us, what are we looking to do? Throw them off their fields? We're saying, make a judgment whether
they
won
any adverse possession claims.
They haven't won any. I mean, they get rights. They get rights given to them by the courts. For instance, until the government finds them areas or proves or makes it legal or leases it to them, and they're offered lease and this and that, the government is still forced to supply them water, electricity, sewerage, education, build schools and this and that. And that's done by other cases that are taken against the government to try and give them necessary services. What we're saying is they deserve services, but it's not something that can happen over 70,000 people over 200,000 acres spread. It needs to be organized. That's what we're asking for. That's what we do. And again, the Negev is really, I bring up the Negev, it's a consensus issue. No one thought the Negev was going to be taken off us, and that's the direction it's going. It's actually given away as private land. No kibbutz, no moshav. 93% of land, if you get the land, it's leased to you. What they're talking about here is actually writing it in the land registry as private land for these Bedouin. Another question, yes?
So has there been any relocation based on judgments?
So up till now, there's no forced relocation. They do clear areas. Al-Araqib is one of them where it's 100%, there was never anything there. It's proven the court. It's now being appealed. Beersheva court said clear them. The government went and cleared their houses out with the bulldozers that you see. It's now gone to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled the same thing, there's no doubt. But it will go to the Supreme Court. We're an open democracy with a strong judicial system. where the government otherwise has given them a lot of carrots, a lot of money given, for instance, the Taravin tribe that was around the fence of Omer. Omer had plans to expand. They needed to build a neighborhood for army officers. It's a big plan to bring all the army bases down, training bases down to the Negev. So they offered amazing plots, a whole new area for the Taravin tribe. The Taravin tribe all signed up for it. They were meant to move. They were moved into another location from there into their finalized houses, which they all built on beautiful pieces of land. And the rest, the only thing is only a third of them moved because the other third were arguing that they now weren't friendly with the other third of the tribe, so they moved back to their original lands and the third stayed where they were. So instead of moving the Taravin tribe from one place to the next, we now have three locations of the Taravin tribe in the Negev, just as an example. Any other questions?
Has the government taken any steps with that judgment where they were given 6 years to relocate?
It only came out 2-3 months ago, and they have 6 years. So yeah, as they do, they'll wait probably to 5.5 years and start looking around. But they do need to move the school off his land straight away. So they've said they'll do that by the next school, beginning of the next school year, because that's government building on someone else's private land. So I have a lot more. I have the videos and the rest, but
we're out of time. Short of time.
Yeah, and I'm not an anti-Zionist, by the way. I mean, we're doing this to, the government actually like us. Gilad Erdan helps us, but it's a bad cop, good cop type situation. The Israeli government has to be seen as this beautiful, clean, good cop doing everything it can to help its minorities, and they tell us, come on, you've got to sue us to force us to do this, because when Catherine Ashton calls Bibi and says, what the hell are you doing in the Negev? He says, the Supreme Court forced me to do this, the same as we enforce the Supreme Court rulings in the West Bank, we also enforce them in the Negev. So that's the game we have to play. We're a tiny organisation, but we're playing on a daily basis and trying to do the best we can.
Ari, thank you very much. It's really been an eye-opener for me to see this, and it's a very interesting presentation. I guess one of the lessons you take away from this is that in the scheme of things where we talk about moving Israelis out of Yehuda and Shomron and moving them to the Negev, that is refocusing Israel's efforts in the Negev for its own population growth, and we realise that the Negev is in fact also disappearing, that it becomes a vital issue for us all in the future going forward. And I would commend all of you to learn more, as I will, about this very interesting topic. Thank you very much for this most thought-provoking presentation, and thank you so much to our hosts for having us up here. Once again, to JBD for inviting the Zionist Council to be a part of this event. Thank you all.